What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Doctors Without Borders, Inside Out. First, a word or a song about the organization's name.
Medicine Sans Frontières, or MSF, means Doctors Without Borders in French.
If you find yourself in Yenagoa, in southern Nigeria, you will hear this song on the radio. Yenagoa is the base for one of the organization's more than 100 projects worldwide.
They call it Medicine Sans Frontières. Means Doctors Without Borders in French.
Yenagoa is the end of the road. From here, if you want to go anywhere, you have to travel on the river. Actually many rivers and innumerable creeks, named and unnamed, but all of them are part of the Niger River Delta, the 14,000 square mile estuary of Africa's third longest river. Although Yenagoa is where MSF is headquartered, the medical team is usually out and about in the Niger River Delta, and you have to find them by boat. You follow the waterways as they flow through mangrove swamps and dense forests of palm, mahogany, and nutmeg trees. It's a primeval world. Turn a bend into one of the smaller creeks, and the cloying fragrance of orchids and wild hyacinth make the jungle smell like a prom night dance floor. The river is also surreally modern. Turn another bend, and you can hear the roar and feel the heat of gas flares. Delta is the heart of Nigeria's oil industry, the industry that makes this West African nation one of the world's major oil exporters. It pumps as much crude as Kuwait and should make this nation Africa's wealthiest, but it doesn't. In the Delta, people's industriousness is in inverse proportion to the poverty in which they live. As you search for the medical team, the river is alive with traffic. Hundreds of dugout canoes ply the waterways, people taking themselves to small clearings where vegetables are planted, or cutting rushes along the riverbanks to make baskets or thatch for roofs, or working their fishing lines, dredging up the catfish and shrimp which teem in the waters. You pass dozens of mud hut villages, and frequently even the best river captains, like MSF's Wilkinson, get lost and have to ask directions.
Hello.
Eventually, though, you find the medical team. This day, the team is in a village called Baron, working in a makeshift clinic.
Manuel, please come.
So, what's wrong with the baby? Are there any problems with the baby?
He doesn't have one and a bang a bang.
So, presently, she's not sick, but she's stooling.
She's stooling.
Yes.
Dr. Chris Lewis, a 27-year-old South African, gently pinches around a chubby baby's torso, checking for signs of dehydration. The exam is conducted in three languages, English, Pidgin English, and the local Ijaw dialect.
Any fevers? Will the body be hot? No. Cheerful looking baby. We want to just chase the blood for malaria, which is the infection of the blood from the mosquito.
Malaria is the leading cause of infant mortality in the Niger River Delta, and it's the focus of this MSF project. Lewis's examining room is in the local elementary school, a cinder block and tin roof structure with no glass in the windows. It's not needed. The climate here, just north of the equator, is constant. Hot.
average year-round temperature is in the 90s. When the young doctor has finished his exam, mother and baby go one classroom down the row to a makeshift lab. There, technician Sunday Ashaolu swabs the baby's toe with alcohol before drawing blood.
Okay. You like me? Mm-hmm. Good girl. Good girl. Good girl.
Back in the examining room, Chris Lewis's colleague, 29-year-old Rachel Hardwick from England, is dealing with a toddler who has the asleep-awake lassitude of a baby with high fever.
And is the stool watery?
It's watery, of course.
Is there blood in it?
It's black in color.
It's black in color?
Yes.
Okay. How many times a day?
About 10 good times.
10 times a day. Okay, fine. We need to check that the child does not have malaria. Okay?
Okay.
So she needs to have a finger prick test.
Okay.
But also, it sounds like the child may have another disease, probably from drinking the water. Okay?
Okay.
But we'll check the malaria first.
Okay.
39, and you don't feel too good at the temperature of 39, I'm sure.
What's 39 in front of you?
104-ish.
The child's mother, wearing a T-shirt that reads, Phil Schmidt and Son, famous for lake perch and frog's legs in Hammond, Indiana, takes her baby to the lab. Kenyan Joseph Wazome, chief lab technician, doesn't have quite the same touch as his assistant Sunday.
Oh, sorry, oh. Sorry.
Our own elementary school is turned into an efficient MSF assembly line with preliminary assessment room, examining room, and finally, Joseph Wazome's makeshift lab. An electric microscope hooked up to a car battery and a clean plate of glass suspended over two Coleman lanterns to dry out the slides that will reveal the presence of the malaria parasite in the children's blood.
These are the slides that we use. All the slides must be very clean. Otherwise, you're not.
How do you manage to keep them clean out in the field?
What we do before we leave bears, we make sure that we wash them. Then we pack them in the slide box so that they're protected from dirt.
How many patients in a day do you expect to draw blood from?
It's a big village, so we expect maybe about 60, 70 slides. And the maximum we've done so far is 144 slides.
Analyzing 144 slides could take days, but it doesn't.
What happens is that, just by mere coincidence, we've been having positive rates as high as 60-70%. So that reduces our time considerably. For a positive smear, it takes you maybe 1 or 2 minutes, but for a negative, it takes much longer.
What does that significant amount of malaria present in the under 5 population tell you?
Because there is water all over. I mean, there are all these breeding sites for the mosquitoes. I mean, that's why we have a lot of malaria around here.
In a way, the Delta Project is a return to the organization's historical roots.
Doctors Without Borders was created by a team of French doctors working for the French Red Cross.
Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, was founded 30 years ago in Nigeria.
In Nigeria, during the Biafra War, they wanted to provide assistance to injured civilians.
The Igbo people in the eastern part of Nigeria tried to secede from the country. The rebellion was brutally suppressed by Nigeria's military rulers. Among their strategies, the deliberate starvation of civilians. The Biafran War was an early paradigm of the kind of anarchic civil war which has come to dominate much of the developing world. It was also the source of a new paradigm of humanitarian work, which grew out of the original humanitarian organization, the Red Cross.
And the French Red Cross then had a lot of young doctors to the Biafra War in 68.
Austin Davis, director of MSF Holland.
And whilst they were working with the Red Cross, trying to promote better and more medical action in the heart of these wars, they also started to see the manipulation and abuse of civil populations before war ends, and they felt that they had to speak out about this. They were unable to do so, because when you join the Red Cross, you commit to silence in what you see. Now, it doesn't mean that the Red Cross never says anything, but they formally agree with both sides in the conflict, their presence. They have to have a formal agreement on both sides, and they use their experience in negotiation with both sides.
So the young French doctors felt constrained by this vow of silence.
Yes, they were passionate activists coming out of the 68 revolution in France. They had a philosophy of action as well as of trying to do good. And I think it was very aggressive and oppositional to the Red Cross in its early and inspirational phase, but it's of the Red Cross. It's very similar in other ways. And to me now, what the main differences are is that states have to recognize the value of humanitarian action and allow it to happen in war. And the Red Cross keeps that responsibility alive. It gets all its money from states. It protects law. I see MSF less formal, more medical. We don't have to negotiate with both sides. We will go in where we can and where it's needed most. And we go directly to the public and we speak out.
Speaking out has earned MSF a controversial reputation. Most humanitarian agencies keep a low profile, not MSF. During the Kosovo crisis, the organization very publicly announced it would accept no funding from any NATO government.
NATO was one of the belligerents in that war. If we were to accept finance and therefore potentially direction from those governments, it would be difficult to claim that we were neutral and impartial. Milosevic's forces did not allow NGOs into Kosovo during the fighting, and they didn't allow people into Serbia. And we were perceived as every bit as much of the Western intervention as anyone else, but we desperately struggled to try and assert our independence.
That is the essence of the organization, independence, as it was meant in radical student politics circa 1968. Independence not as a political state, but as a zealous expression of mission. In fact, going into the field to work on a project is called going on a mission. Each step in the organization's growth these last three decades has been weighed against how it would affect people's ability to carry out their medical relief missions independently. Today, rather than one centrally managed organization, there are different sections of MSF in 18 countries, each under its own management, including the original in France, but also branches in the U.S., Spain, and Australia, among others. The Delta Project is an MSF Holland initiative. The sense of independence extends to the organization's finances. MSF workers receive minimal wages, yet the overall annual budget for the organization is $284 million. Three-quarters of that sum comes from private sources. There are millions of individual donors. And, of course, last year, there was the one-time-only income from the Nobel Peace Prize. The decision to set up the program in Nigeria came out of several years of internal debate.
Everyone knows Afghanistan, long time in war, Sudan, long time in war, Sierra Leone, long time in war. It's obvious MSF should be there, no problem. Should we be in Nigeria? It's a huge country with regional ambitions of power. It is not one of the forgotten African states. From that perspective, one would say no. From another perspective, it's a country where there is a large degree of violence, and that's not dissociated social violence, that's group organized violence.
So, having determined that the people of the Delta met the organization's basic definition of a population at risk, the anti-malaria project was set up last year. Today, there are 7 foreign nationals, expatriates in MSF terms, plus 35 employees from Yanagoa. When we come back, a look at the day-to-day problems the expats face in the field and at their base. I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Doctors Without Borders, Inside Out.
In the Niger Delta, MSF based in Yenagoa. It had a small team of foreign and Nigerian staff, MSF. Medicine Sans Frontier, MSF. Mr. Dr. Without Borders, in France.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. Coming up at 9 on The Connection, A Canadian Christmas. We'll hear stories written and read by Margaret Atwood and Alistair MacLeod. And a favorite Canadian children's story, The Hockey Sweater. That's coming up at 9 on the first hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. And by Direct Hire and Auto Service, winner of the 2001 Retailer of the Year Award by the Retail...
Goldfarb, and this is Doctors Without Borders, Inside Out. The expatriate team in Yenagoa, two doctors, a nurse, a lab technician, project coordinator, administrator, and logistician, live in a small compound behind barbed wired walls. Next door is a similar compound for Texaco workers. Project coordinator Bernard Leservoisier says the first task for MSF in the town, capital of Bayelsa State, was to make sure the locals knew his people didn't work for the oil companies.
One of the first priorities was to organize a big public relation and advocacy campaign, because until our arrival in late last year, the only other white people around were oil company workers. So there was big concern on us that we might be mistaken for oil workers and as a result suffer the same fate of oil workers, meaning risking to be kidnapped or having our property seized and so on.
It's a genuine concern. Kidnap and ransom is a growth industry in the area. 250 oil workers were seized in the Delta last year.
We try to make it clear to everybody that we have no hidden agenda. We are here to provide free medical assistance. We are not here to spy on people. We are not here to collect data that we will send to our own government. We are not a cover-up for an oil company. And actually, people appreciate the fact that we go and live in the village. And yeah, I don't think there is any other foreign people actually living in villages for a long time.
Security is Bernard's obsession. The big event during my time in Yenagoa was Dr. Rachel Hardwick's arrival on the mission. And not just because she brought a mass of new CDs and board games to help while away the evenings. The Cambridge-educated doctor brought a huge amount of energy and enthusiasm with her as well. Rachel's first days were spent in a round of security indoctrination.
You first take the radio off scan to reset it. And you do that by pressing the PC button.
Logistician Sander Hammer taught her how to use the walkie-talkie radio.
And this sound means that the other radio is phoned.
And Bernard explained the Yenagoa dress code meant Rachel should not go out in shorts.
Nice legs, and there are not that many beautiful white women around, so if you have a short like that, you will arise 10 times more attention. So if you want to walk out, you have to take your handset with you. You have to tell me or another expat here before you leave where you go, how long you plan to be there, when you expect to come back. You're probably aware that we had 4 burglaries in this compound. We had one in January, one in March, one in May, one in July. In March, the burglars broke in the house with a machete and iron bars and stole our personal belongings.
Unlike the midnight machete raid, the violence along the river is a matter of report, not personal experience. Pirates work the waterways. Youths from one village murderously attack youths from another. The pretext frequently is land ownership, as the oil companies seek to pay for the right to drill in one place or another. In Bernard's office is a detailed map of the Delta. The doctors do not go where there are reports of violence.
And the 94. It's easy.
A child can do the washing.
Baron, however, is safe, and on the surface, it's a happy place. As the medical team works in its makeshift clinic, a crowd of kids, 6, 7, 8 years old, watch from the windows. In a world without television, this is entertainment.
Uibo
means white man in the local language. In Baron, a sighting of a white person is slightly less rare than the sighting of a moose in the jungle. The children crowd into the preliminary assessment room where the head of the MSF team, Nurse Astrid Kostelik, is explaining the setup to Bernard Lesavoisier.
Then I check the temperatures and I see if it's necessary for them to see the doctor or not, and I give them a number. Then they go over there.
The doctor.
Then they go off to see the doctor. Some of them I will send away because they don't have fever and they're over 5. Yeah, preferably you try not to test these young, healthy men because usually they're not sick at all. That can be a bit difficult because they always want to be tested.
So if they're not sick, you tell them thank you.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thank you. You have no fever. You're okay. Sometimes people are very disappointed, of course.
Although malaria is the primary focus of the medical team's work, in this ward, where there are no doctors, their arrival brings everyone who is not well to the clinics, if they can make it. Frequently, it's too late. The previous day, the doctors had encountered a 2-year-old dying of fever. They didn't have the right medicine to treat the child, and Dr. Chris Lewis doubted the girl would survive the 3-hour boat journey to a hospital. I asked him if it was hard to examine someone for whom he could do so little.
I would say one of the main stresses is not being able to do all you can for the patient. Perhaps not having the right equipment to perform necessary operation, not having the skills. The whole setup is that patients will come to you at a very late stage. That's the other thing, and, you know, not being able to do enough, I think, is a major source of stress.
In the examining room, Bernard watched Dr. Rachel Hardwick examine a boy of about 9 with infected wounds on his shins.
And they've become infected, and he's become septicemic. He's had infection throughout his bloodstream. So we're giving him antibiotics.
No, the spirit is free now.
I hope so.
No spirit anymore?
His uncle had slashed the boy's shins just above the ankles with a machete to free evil spirits lurking inside.
What's that again?
To free the spirits.
So if you don't cut this thing, you can walk into their trap and thereafter you will sick and die.
Of all the obstacles this team faces in caring for people, poor sanitation in the villages, no roads leading to them, the biggest obstacle the doctors have to overcome is the resistance of the villagers to Western medicine. The power of traditional spiritual practice is very strong. The Niger River Delta is a profoundly Christian area, but it is also profoundly animist. Across the river from Yenagoa, perhaps 600 yards upstream, is the village of Aqaba. In Aqaba this day, the village is holding a yam festival. The heavy rains have finished for the year, and it's time to plant yams, the dietary staple here. The local priest is led by a chorus of women through the village to a mud hut, where a statue of a spirit, or juju, Arugogeni Onorisa, is kept. Juju is a pipe-smoking woman. The chicken has been sacrificed between her breasts. Blood and feathers are coagulated down her torso, and the blood runs down the steps of the hut. The whole village gathers in front of the shrine while a talking drum summons the heads of each family inside to make an offering to Arugogeni to ensure a good harvest. Simeon, the village priest, accepts the money on behalf of the juju. He pours a shot glass of palm wine. He splashes half of it between the juju's breasts and gives the other half to the supplicant. He then gives the supplicant some white chalk with which to mark his face. Just the other side of the river in Yenagoa, you can see radio antennas and gas flares. The town's streets are lined with Pentecostal churches, and in the shops, Western modernity can be purchased for a comparatively modest price. Although not half a mile away, the world of Yenagoa would seem to be as far from the sacrificial rituals of this world as it is possible to get. Yet most of the people taking part in the Yam celebration go to Yenagoa regularly. They work there, shop there. But Westerners see as two distinct worlds is just one world for these celebrants. When the MSF team works along the river, all their modern science has to compete for a place in people's minds against all the power of this belief. And as the doctors don't live permanently in the villages, and the traditional medicine men do, they have an uphill battle to bring what they would consider good practice to the people of the Niger River Delta. Away from medicine, the biggest problem the expats have to deal with is boredom. Boredom combined with the climate. Heat and humidity never go away. The compound, a one-story office building which is air-conditioned, living quarters which are not, and a mud and thatched roof meeting house for the national staff are connected by a raised wooden walkway because the ground is frequently a quagmire after a heavy rain. And then there is the noise. Nigeria is one noisy country. Music blares out from every nook and cranny, and electric generators rattle and hum day and night. By MSF standards, the living quarters in Yenagoa are quite decent, about graduate student group house level. All the expats have their own bedrooms, and there are three bathrooms for seven people. And true luxury, they have sit-down toilets. But for the 12 months that a mission lasts, the quarters are awfully close. A group sense of fun is very useful.
Go. Oh, no!
The house game is a race against the clock, kicking a soccer ball along the wooden walkway through the mud hut.
I thought the French were good at football.
But when the weather is bad, there's not a lot to do except listen to the thunder dropping 40,000 feet through clouds that spread out for miles. Going out in town is possible, although the bars are pretty basic. The best off-compound break for the MSF medical team is church on Sunday, guaranteed to lift your spirits. Rachel Astrid and I went to the Winner's Chapel the Sunday I was in town. Astrid was particularly interested in going. She had been brought up in the Dutch Pentecostal church, and the Winners called itself a Pentecostal congregation, although Astrid found the hymn arrangements were not quite the same as the ones she grew up with. After the service, we decided to walk the mile or so back to the compound along Yenagoa's single, impossibly crowded road. The street was one long shopping and eating opportunity. Restaurants with the sign, "Food is ready," every 20 yards or so, and dozens of clothing stores, one of which had a sign reading, "Looking good is God's will," and naming a verse from Leviticus to back up the point. We started poking through a stack of glorious textiles, and I asked Astrid when she had decided to join MSF.
In 1981 or something, I went to Kenya with a Pentecostal church. And you had to try to convert people into being a Christian. And after that, I thought, well, this is such a bullshit way of believing. So I stopped believing. But I always thought I'd like to go back. Maybe I should become a nurse and I go back. So finally, 2 years ago, I decided, well, it's now or never. If you really want to do this, I'm getting older, and you should do it.
We ducked into a little cafe for a cool drink. It was clear that Astrid and Rachel felt constrained by life in the compound.
Well, if ever I'm anywhere, I want to walk the streets. I want to see how things are. And I think it is very important for MSF if we are a presence on the street and in the villages where we're actually going to work. And I think if we hide in the compound the whole time, we're not promoting the image that we want to promote. We want to come and we want to integrate into the community.
That's what's happening a little bit. People stay too much in the compound, and I myself as well. And but we, when we are in the field, you go out a lot. But here, for some reason, because the streets are so busy and all that, but nah, this is okay, it's fine. But it's also a lot of people don't have any need to go outside of the compound. They just feel perfectly happy. They don't feel restless, and it drives me mad. That's also a reason why I couldn't do this for years, really.
Although Astrid may feel that she couldn't do another mission, most people who do it once do it again. Last year, 70% of MSF workers in the field were on their second or third missions. This continuity of personnel allows the organization to remain surprisingly faithful to its founding spirit. More on the core of the organization after the break. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is Doctors Without Borders, Inside Out. From Boston University, this is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Gamma Knife Center at New England Medical Center, providing an alternative to open brain surgery through precisely focused radio surgery. Details at bostongammaknifecenter.org. By Nortec, creating building products to help improve the comfort and security of homes and workplaces around the world. And by Forte Cashmere Company, a third-generation Boston-based family business presenting its new website, cashmere.com, featuring 100% cashmere garments for holiday gift-giving on the web at cashmere.com. Just ahead at 9 on The Connection, a Canadian Christmas. We'll hear several stories, including a favorite Canadian children's story, The Hockey Sweater. That's coming up at 9 on the first hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon. 35 degrees in Boston and 31 in Westerly.
Barry Steinberg, President and CEO of Direct Hire, a WBUR underwriter.
Our mission statement, obviously, at Direct Hire is to do the best job we can every day. It's pretty simple, but it's straight to the point. And I think BUR delivers news and information the best they can do every day. And our customers and your listeners really appreciate that.
Underwriting on WBUR says a lot for your business. For more information, call 617-353-8451.
I'm Michael Goldfarb, and this is Doctors Without Borders, Inside Out. When the organization won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1999, Dr. James Orbinski, president of the MSF International Council, used the occasion to restate the group's core mission.
It's a prize that recognizes that the kind of humanitarian action that MSF engages in is independent of political or military considerations, independent of state-based considerations, but one that responds primarily to the dignity of people is a valid humanitarian action. And for us, humanitarian action is both providing medical humanitarian assistance as well as speaking out on behalf of populations in danger.
Acting to help populations in danger in the public mind means helping people in war zones. Inside MSF, it means something broader, establishing projects in Nicaragua to help street children, for example, or in Uzbekistan to deal with the health problems caused by the environmental disaster of the disappearance of the Aral Sea. Not that MSF doesn't work in war zones anymore. It certainly does. But most of its 3,000 expat staff are working in places like Nigeria, where poverty and anarchic local conditions are the great danger to people's health, not armies. Winning the Nobel Prize gave the organization its highest profile ever, but that hasn't changed the internal culture with its origins in 60s-style notions of egalitarianism. There is still what critics call an overabundance of 60s radical co-op self-analysis, or navel-gazing, over every move the group makes. MSF Holland's Austin Davis wouldn't have it any other way.
What's my...
This branch of the Niger, the River Bonny, runs through the heart of the Delta oil industry. It was like riding through the aftermath of a World War II naval battle. Dozens of derelict tankers and drilling platforms had been towed upstream from the Atlantic drilling fields and beached, half sunk, or left to ride at anchor, rusting into eternity. Beaches were fouled with oil muck, and one floating pipeline was gushing a fountain of black gunk into the air. Still, the familiar dugout canoes worked the shoreline, dredging up catfish and shrimp. We drove close to the estuary, close enough for the air to get an ocean tang and the waves to get a serious chop before turning around and coming back.
We sat on the dock, talking about the most difficult moment in medical relief work, the moment when you have to evacuate the mission. Martin Braxma had been through it recently in Goma, near the Democratic Republic of the Congo's border with Rwanda.
But, I mean, do you guys actually keep an active plan for evacuation from any given place?
We have very strict security plans, which include an evacuation plan. That's just a rule within MSF.
So how did it work in Goma?
It worked fairly well, but, well, some of us maybe were a little bit too late. We were stuck, and there were approximately some 125 aid workers left at that time. The war was coming closer and closer to town. So eventually we got out with the UN, and on the day we evacuated, the Rwandese army moved in from Rwanda.
But how is the decision made?
Yeah, let me try to explain how MSF looks at evacuation. It's not only insecurity so much, but it's linked to whether we would still be able to work. And under such circumstances, it's just impossible to work. So then there's no real reason to take any extra risks.
Later that evening, at a hotel in Port Harcourt, Sander and I sat in the air-conditioned comfort of the bar, talking about his life. Sander, a tall, good-looking man in his late 20s, was born into this work. Both his parents are doctors, and both worked for humanitarian organizations, including MSF, while their children were growing up. Unlike Nurse Astrid Kostelik, who is taking a break from her real life to go on a mission, Sander's real life is medical relief work. It's a life people on the outside don't comprehend.
People who not really, really know me, like, they think that, yeah, it's cool what you're doing for adventure and for doing good for somebody else. But in Western European culture, money-making is a big thing, and that's what we are not doing. And also getting settled, getting a future, that kind of stuff. That's very important for people. So that's why a lot of people who have these ideas, they don't do it because they think other things in life, like getting a relationship, is more important.
Yeah. Do you have a relationship?
No. For me, always I had a feeling that when I have to choose between a relationship or the mission, I choose for the mission.
What do you think, what's your impression of what motivates people to do this work?
Yeah, there has been an enquête, a questionnaire amongst people in MSF about what the motivations were for working with MSF. And then adventure scored very high. Looks good on your CV for medical people, scores very high. Working in the tropics, doing something different, scores high. And then, yeah, a bit lower is because is the fact that you want to do good for other people. I think, for me, I cannot say what exactly is.
I thought you said you did this mission because your mom told you to.
Yeah, of course. My mom says, I don't want you at home anymore. We live all our lives happy and rich, and now you go and help other people. No, it's not true.
Sander, as a second-generation MSF worker, has a good handle on the realities of life on mission. Not all do. Around 1 in 10 seek therapy after they return. In Britain, they see MSF counselor Valerie Wistrick.
People often have unrealistic expectations. This type of work can be viewed as quite romantic and exciting and quite sexy. The reality is that in the field it can be mundane sometimes, it can be very frustrating in projects, for example, with security issues where you can be evacuated on a fairly regular basis, which keeps interrupting your work. So there is a question about, you know, what am I doing here? What have I achieved over the past 6 months? I think it's important for people to have as realistic a picture as possible. I think it's important to dash some of the rose-tinted images that people have of this type of work. I think it's dangerous to send people to the field who are too idealistic, because I think those people in particular can be very damaged. Certainly, their idealism will be crushed at some point, because the reality is often it makes no difference.
At the clinic in Baron, nurse Astrid Kostelik seemed to have gone the full journey from idealism to disappointment to acceptance of the limitations of her mission.
So once every 3 months giving treatment for malaria is not very effective because, that's not going to do a lot of good. And then I was getting quite frustrated because I thought, what's the use of doing it? But now I know if you gather the information and you can say, hey, 70-80% of the children under 5 have the malaria parasite and there's no health facilities there and you can do something with that information.
What can you do with it?
Present it to the Ministry of Health, maybe to the WHO if we do the study or whatever. I mean, that's probably more useful than a treatment itself. It's so limited. You may save a few lives, but I don't think that you're being very effective.
And even if you could have a doctor in each village, it might make no difference. Baron's school teacher, Oliver, had been pressed into service as a translator for the clinic. He asked if Rachel Hardwick would examine his daughter, who was, strictly speaking, too old to be seen at the clinic. But Rachel couldn't refuse. She examined the girl.
She doesn't have malaria, but she has this cough for a long time, and she's getting thinner, she's losing weight. Now, there's an infection of the chest called tuberculosis. Have you heard of tuberculosis? Yeah? It may be that she has it. We do not have the equipment here to test for it. So the best thing is to take her to hospital and they can do an X-ray of her chest and they can see. And they can also do a test on the skin to see if she has it. Because if she does, she will need treatment. We cannot diagnose it here and we do not have the medicines either to treat it. So the best thing is, if possible, to take her to the nearest hospital to get it off properly. Okay?
Okay. Understood. Understood.
Understood. Yeah. Good.
But travel to the hospital in Yanagoa is time-consuming, 3 hours by boat, and expensive, more than a day's pay. When Rachel turns away, I ask the translator whether he will follow the doctor's advice.
So will you take your daughter to have this disease checked?
Amin?
Yeah. This girl who may have tuberculosis, will you be taking her?
Let me think about it first. Okay. Let me think about it first.
It didn't seem likely that Oliver would be taking his daughter for emergency treatment. At the end of the day, the whole team retired to an improbable house, a suburban-style ranch number, the only non-mud-walled building in the village. It was owned by a local grandee who worked for the oil business. The group chilled out to their personal soundtrack, music by Nigerian Fela Kuti, and began to demolish a jerry can of palm wine. This was Rachel's first field trip, and she and Chris started talking about what was required for a doctor trained in the big city to psychologically survive in this environment.
One of the things that MSF needs to guard against is sending new graduates, putting them into situations where they are helpless, where they feel completely helpless. In fact, they are helpless. And they're put into positions and situations where they do not have the resources or the skills to cope.
Well, why would it kill a new graduate as opposed? I mean, you guys are both pretty young. I mean, you finished your training only a few years ago.
Because you realize your fallibility. When you first graduate, you want to save everybody.
Yeah.
You don't realize that sometimes you fail and that sometimes there are things beyond your power, really. And you come across those, even in the West, when you just hit a brick wall. There's nothing you can do. The social situation, usually is the social situation, is such that things aren't going to change, and much as you'd like to change things, you cannot mend everything. And so you become a little bit more philosophical.
After dinner, I found myself talking to laboratory technician Joseph Wazome. I wondered how he felt as an African coming to another African country on an aid mission with a group of Europeans.
Yeah, that is something very positive. I mean, forget about my colleagues who are from Europe. I'm from Kenya, and I've come to work here in Nigeria. It doesn't mean that there are no laboratory professionals in Nigeria. They are there. But we have Nigerians who are also working elsewhere. I have a Nigerian friend who is presently working in China. Yeah. So I think this is a service which can be offered. As a humanitarian organization, we can offer our services anywhere in the world. It doesn't have to be only in Africa. Wherever there is need, I feel we can just move in and offer aid. Yeah.
As the evening wore on, the village kids, who had been watching us through the windows, slowly snuck into the house.
Suddenly the curtains were twitching.
One by one, they fell asleep. When we were ready for bed, Astrid tried to shoo them out.
Astrid, behind you still. Turn around. I think that's it.
The team in Baron and raced up the river. The jungle was a rainbow made from shades of a single color, green. Streaks of white, egrets perched along the shore, added visual counterpoint to the verdant tones. It was a rare kind of beauty, yet I found myself feeling blue. As I traveled from this primeval peasant world to London in the space of a day, the blues accelerated. Just as Sandra had described, I arrived in Yenagoa with the outsider's romantic view of what medical relief work was like, and the reality was so much the opposite. My blues were threatening to slide into a mild depression when I spoke to MSF executive Austin Davis. Davis tried to cheer me up with a dose of MSF medicine, one part realism, three parts prescriptive idealism.
It's quite a small, depressive little project, humanitarianism. And to keep being small, depressive, saying what you're not the whole time, rather than dreaming of what you might be, is sometimes difficult and depressing. Mm. But still very important, because it focuses on one thing, certain human values, human sympathy and human outrage at the suffering and attack on human dignity of others, which should be an important part of our own dignity. If you walk past someone sitting on the streets, as we all have in our Western towns, you know, in a pale blue sleeping bag, asking for money, you know, it takes something out of you. You feel a bit ashamed. Do I give money? No, because if I give money, then I'm promoting this kind of thing. If you walk past the same person and they've been brutally attacked and their leg is broken and a piece is sticking out, there's no way you can walk past them anymore. It is an affront to your humanity. And those people are there. They just happen to be 1,000 miles away.
You may not know who these people are, but the funny thing is, despite all the talk of the global village and American cultural dominance, in Baron, they don't know who you are either.
Say hello to America.
Huh?
Say hello to America.
Hello.
Hello to who?
Hello, Mom.
Hello, America. Where is America?
Huh?
Do you know what America is?
I don't know.
You don't know what America is?
Yes.
America is where I come from.
I don't know.
This is Doctors Without Borders, Inside Out. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I walk a many village and we are in Africa. I walk a many village and we are in Africa. Waka waka waka,
waka waka waka.
I go many places,
waka waka waka.
I go government places,
waka waka waka.
I see,
waka waka waka.
All the bad things,
waka waka waka.
Then they do,
waka waka waka.
They steal all the money,
waka waka waka.
They kill many students,
waka waka waka.
They burn many houses,
waka waka waka.
They burn my house too,
waka waka waka.
They kill my mama,
waka waka waka.
So I carry the coffin,
waka waka waka.
I waka waka waka,
waka waka waka.
Go a ballerina.